Good morning, Toronto. Hello, Canada. And actually, warm welcome to everybody that is watching us on the live streaming on Channel 9 today. You know, it's great to be back here in Canada with the Build Tour. We've been, like my team has been on the road over the last few weeks with the Build Tour. We've been to Australia, to Europe, to India. But we are here actually for the second year in a row. And I think one thing I love about the Build Tour is that it gives us the opportunity to meet with developers and talk to developers. And let me tell you, there is no better time to be a developer. There is so much innovation going on, right? Whether it's on the devices, new form factor, new gadgets coming out, on the cloud, on the bots. And that's what we are here today to talk about. I actually want to start from the pillars that Mary talked about and just give you some idea. You know, at Microsoft, our goal is to provide the technology, but also help you to be successful across all of these pillars. So I want to give you, share with you some of the momentum we are seeing behind each of these. Let's start with the cloud and, you know, the intelligent cloud. We've been working hard to really build like an hyperscale footprint of data center around the world. Just here in Canada, last month, we opened two new data centers, one in, here in Toronto and the other one in Quebec City. And the reason we did that is because we know how important it is for your data to be as close as possible to your customers. And we are doing this globally. In fact, we have 30 data centers now worldwide, which, to put it in perspective, you know, is just bigger than AWS and Google Cloud combined. And once you have all this cloud power, you know, we have seen a lot of developers coming and building great web applications. They're using data. They're using actually also new devices. Let me tell you this about IoT devices. I love this. You know, let me snap my finger. Okay, I missed a second. There. In that second, 3.3 million IoT messages got just processed on Microsoft Azure. That's how much data we are receiving and we are processing, you know, real time on Azure. And Azure also provides a lot of services with platform as a service, whether it's Azure Active Directory or if you're developers, Visual Studio Team Services. There is a lot happening there. It is not used just by big enterprises. It's also used by startups and ISVs. And we're seeing a great momentum and demand from this audience. It's not just about the cloud. It's also about productivity. And we say we are trying to reinvent the productivity. And Office today, you know, represents a great opportunity. We have over 1 billion users of Office. And think about those as users where you can expose to your services and your content. How? Through the Microsoft Graph APIs. And we're seeing, in fact, a huge growth in terms of adoption of the Graph APIs that allow you to reach that Office base. And we're going to talk about this today. And then, lastly, when we think about Windows and reinventing, you know, a more personal computing experience, you know, Windows 10 is by far the most successful Windows we ever produced. We are now at over 300 million devices, and users are using it for business, for in the enterprise, for games. And actually, something that is interesting to look at is they are talking more with Windows through Cortana. I really like that 6 billion questions asked to Cortana. I like the fact that, you know, Cortana is becoming such an important part of our life. And then when we think about Windows, it's also about the store. With Windows 10, we introduced the store across all of the devices, including the PC. And we're seeing a lot of users coming to the store to search for their apps and search for the content. Over 5 billion visits to the store. And that's an opportunity for developers to bring existing content or build new content and make that available and discoverable to your users. Windows is not just about, you know, our family. It's also about connecting Windows to other devices. Here's like an interesting quote from NPR that is saying that since they released the Windows app on the universal app on PC, they're actually seeing, you know, good adoption on PC, but also on their other devices. And that's great. We want to enable you as developers to build great experiences across any platform. And so today we're here to talk about this. We're here to talk about the opportunity to build apps on Windows, on Azure, and Office. And together, this platform gives you capabilities for an intelligent cloud coupled with end-to-end device platform. Now, let me tell you also that this is everything that I'm going to cover today with regards to numbers. You are developers, we are developers, we're here to have a developer conversation. And so when we thought, what content can we take with us on the road when we do the Build Tour? We decided to go very heavy on demos and to make it very like heavy on code And we brought with us some preview bits of OS and tools. In fact, maybe too many of these. Something might crash here or there. But we figure you're developers, so probably that's the part you're going to enjoy most, right? Because let's be honest, like we like to fix code that when something crashes. And if we write anything wrong, just raise your hands and correct us, right? We are here to do this live, real time. And the story that I want to tell you today is a developer story. And so we're going to talk about building applications for Windows. We're going to talk about the universal platform, how you can take existing investments and bring them to the store, but also how you can build on the new platform. We're going to talk about building applications across all devices, whether you're using Xamarin or you're building web applications. And that also means, you know, other endpoints, for example, bots, or for example, IoT, and how to add services to all of these endpoints and connect it to data. So that's the agenda for the rest of the keynote. Let's get started. And let's start with the idea of Windows being home for developers. You know, we really invest a lot in Windows when we think about developers. In fact, you know, if you look at the settings, if you go in Windows 10 and you open the settings, you have an entire section dedicated just for you, for developers, to tweak your environment. That's how much we care about developers when we think and engineer Windows. It's not just about that, but it's about also listening to the feedback we get from developers. And one of the feedback we receive is that you want to be more productive on Windows, and you want to be able to leverage some of the tools that exist, for example, on Linux today, or Unix. And so at Build, we announced that we're going to bring some of these productivity tools into Windows 10. In fact, the current flight of Windows gives you support for things like Bash. And so there is no better way to actually try this than just showing a demo. And so let me invite on stage Pete Brown to show you Bash.
So what I wanted to show you a bit here today is some of the cool things that we're doing with bringing you know, the Linux subsystem for Windows here in partnership with Canonical. So I have been a Windows user for a very, very long time, but I've also been somebody who's used Linux for different projects at home. I have an Ubuntu server at home that I run Minecraft on, et cetera. And then I'm able to use some of the new tools that we have here, such as the Bash shell, to be able to do things like, you know, SSH directly into my server that I have at home. Now, because this is a full Linux subsystem, you expect to be able to do things like, say, Ruby, right? So I can say, let's say, Ruby slash E, and I'll do, let's see, print hello world, right, slash N, and close that. And you just expect that to be able to work, right? There are lots of different tools, lots of different open source projects and scripts that are out there that you expect to be able to use, especially if you are a web developer or web designer. So speaking of web designers here, let's say, for example, that I want to do some Python stuff. Now, I do a lot with the Raspberry Pi as well, so I'm familiar with the Nano editor, so I'm just going to use Nano. Of course, you can use Emacs or Vi or anything like that, and say nano hello world.py, okay? And I'm going to say print, how do you generate a random character string in Linux? Anybody know? All right, what you want to do is sit a web designer. Any web designers in the room? I'm going to close your ears for a second here. In front of VI and ask them to save and exit. All right. Here we go. So I can save this, Control O, Control X, and I say Python hello world. Okay? And that just works. Now, that's interesting, and that's going to give you access to tons of different open source stuff that's out there, tons of things on GitHub and whatnot. But I wanted to do something slightly more complicated here. Now, I'm a really old school gamer, and by old school, I mean going back to games that were, you know, predate graphics in their terminal mode and whatnot. So I have a copy here of NetHack. And NetHack is, you know, the original dungeon crawler written for Unix systems back in, you know, the early 80s and late 70s. And I have it in a local repo. So I am going to clone that using Git here. So git clone, and I'm going to use the file system that is on my Windows PC. So I say mount c git NetHack. Okay. And again, I'm able to use these tools because I am actually on the Windows PC and I'm not a VM or something like that. All the drives are automatically mounted for me and I have access to this. Very, very seamless. So this gets pulled down here. All right, so that's great. And now I can go directly into that folder. Actually, you know, one thing I do want to do is I know that this uses curses as a graphics library, so I want to make sure that I have that installed. So I could say apt install libn curses dev, because we expect these types of things to run. Again, not a VM, not an emulation or anything like this. The actual Ubuntu binaries work here. I see I've already got that. Go into the NetHack folder, hit make all. Now, this uses GCC and Lex and Yak and a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm not going to make you sit here and watch this whole process. It takes a couple of minutes. Back in the day, it used to take a good 30 minutes or so. So I'm going to go into my folder here where I've already got this stuff in, say NetHack install, games, there we go, and run it. All right, yes, pick that. I ended up as a ranger. I was growing a beard here, hoping to be a wizard. I guess it didn't work out, so let me just go through. And then I can navigate through this game. And again, this is the original dungeon crawler that many people are familiar with, caused many people to stay up late nights in college and whatnot. I'm going to exit that. Quit. Yes. You can see I made the high score list. And now just one last thing that I want to show you here. Again, because remember, we are on Windows. This is part of Windows. This is not something that is completely separate. If I go over here, there is a hidden folder in the app data folder, which I'm running as root, which I know is, you know, not something that you typically want to do. But if I go into that root folder, I can see there's my NetHack folder that I had. So if I do Windows +++, so you can see, there is all the NetHack stuff. There are all the other things that are in my home folder, right? Again, just as part of the Windows file system. So now this is going to give you access, again, to all of the different tools and all the different technologies and scripts and all the stuff that's been done for Linux on Windows without you having to go and run a separate operating system, a separate server, a separate PC. So very cool stuff, especially for some of the web developers out there. It's cool. Thanks, Georgia.
Thank you, Pete.
And I'm just going to wait downstairs, OK?
All right. I'll call you back later. So that's just one thing, one of the features we included in Windows 10 to make to help developers be more productive. Another feedback we got from developers is that you guys have investments of application that you build over several years. And you know, we are building a new platform, but what's the path in between? And so we wanted to make it as easy as possible for you to maintain your current investments and at the same time start getting started on a new platform. And we've been investing on a number of projects to enable you to do that, whether you're coming from WPF or Silverlight or even iOS code. And there is one project in particular that I want to discuss today, and that's the Windows Desktop Bridge, also called Project Centennial. Project Centennial is a tool that allows you to take your Win32 applications, so it could be WinForms, WPF, doesn't matter, like any Win32 application. Today, you're probably packaging using an MSI installer. Project Centennial allows you to turn that MSI installer into an APEX file. And APEX is the installer technology that we use for the universal Windows platform. It comes with a lot of advantages. It's faster, it's more secure, it helps installing and uninstalling the apps more easily from the PC. And all of that comes for free. You don't need to change any of your code. And you can continue to distribute that APEX file to other PCs, or if you want, you can even submit it to the store. Why would you submit it to the store? Well, as I say, there are 5 billion visits there, people looking for content and for your apps. But also, once you do that, you get access to all of the universal platform APIs that unblocks like a lot of the new capabilities into your apps. It also unblocks new type of businesses, if you'd like. You can connect into the Microsoft Commerce platform from your applications without, from your existing code, without the need to rewrite your application. And so again, to show you this, I'm going to call back Pete from somewhere to show you this.
A little bit of an experiment at Microsoft with something that I think is a slightly newer game. I showed you a game that was 35 years old, so let me show you something that's at least from the 90s. And so what we've done is we've done a little bit of packaging here with Quake 3 Arena. And we took Quake 3 as it exists today, and we just wrapped it, the compiled version. You see it's about half a gig. I'm going to click install. It really does install that fast. I'm going to launch that. Yes. Let me make this full screen. There we go. You can tell it's real because I got the firewall block here. There we are. Hello, there we are. All right, now I'm gonna go in and just play. You can tell by listening to it that it's working just fine. But that's okay, because I want to play it anyway, because I don't usually...
Welcome to Quake 3 Arena to begin combat.
How much time do I have to play this? Okay. All right, so let me just go in, leave the arena here for a second. Now, all we did was we packaged that. We took the existing binaries, you ran them through the desktop converter, and so we have the new installer technology there. Now, if I go back over to Visual Studio, one of the things that we wanted to try was, well, let's, since we've got this package and since the source code is all available online on GitHub, let's add a little bit of stuff to that. So we went in and enabled something, in-app purchases, right, using the Windows 10 APIs in Quake. And we did this by just adding in a check to see, are we on UWP? If we are, then we're going to light up those features. That way we can still work on Windows 7 and all the things that you would expect. And then we have an additional file here, this UWP lib, that has the calls to be able to, show the store UI and be able to purchase a product. So if I go back into the app and run this and click on multiplayer setup, I get the ability to go and buy this through an in-app purchase. I hit buy, and then we'll have the multiplayer stuff available. So you see now that's just available. So it's a great way for you to take an existing application and either just package it to take advantage of the installer technology or package it and then modify the source code to be able to light up and use new features on Windows 10.
Right. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Later in the day, we're going to show you even more details how Project Centennial works. And by the way, we heard a lot of great feedback about this demo. Since Quake 3 Arena is open source, we're also going to open source soon, like the code that we show you today. So I just give you a quick overview of some of the investments we're making to help developers be more productive on Windows. The other big investment we're doing, and this is for the long-term platform, is what we call UWP, Universal Windows Platform. UWP is the platform that powers all of the Windows 10 devices, whether that's a PC, a phone, an Xbox, HoloLens, IoT. And it comes with a common set of APIs, comes with a common set of tools through Visual Studio, and also of services. There is one store, you just need to have one account, and you can deploy across all of these devices. In Build, we also announced an update to UWP and to Windows. We call it Anniversary Update, and that is coming this summer. It will be an update both to the operating system as well as to the SDK to build applications for the operating system. As developers, you can leverage this today. You can just sign up to become a Windows Insider if you're not already. How many Windows Insiders in the room, by the way? Great, love to see it. And if you're not yet, you can just sign up, it's free, and you can get access, very early access, to all of the content that we're showing you here today. And so, although the platform is the same, each device actually brings unique capabilities and unique user experiences. So let me highlight just a few that where we brought news at Build. The first one is Continuum. Continuum is the ability to take your phone and then connect it through a docking station or Miracast to a screen and a Bluetooth keyboard and mouse. And make, basically, it turns a phone into a full, powerful PC. At Build, we also announced the ability to take the phone and project to another PC, so it doesn't have to be just a monitor. So very powerful stuff there. From an IoT perspective, another announcement we make at Build is that Windows for IoT Core is now supporting 64 bits and is also supporting the latest IoT hardware, for example, the Raspberry Pi 3. And we have six of them on stage today, so we're going to show you a lot of demos of the Pis. And then the last one that gets me really excited is about Xbox. Now you can take any Xbox One console and turn it into a developer kit. So if you already have a console at home or if you buy one in the shop, there is a simple procedure, it's free, and as developers, you can turn that into a developer console and start building and testing applications on your console. It's super cool. In fact, we wanted to show you all of this in action. Now, just a bit of warning for the next demo. The next demo is going to work with a lot of preview builds and a lot of devices and a lot of network and a lot of things, as you will shortly see. So it's possible that something might go wrong, but please, finger crossed, stay with me. So my team asked me to build a Hello World demo, and we normally show something very simple and stupid, and so I thought, let's build something more complex and make it, more risky. So let me show you the application first, and then I'm going to comment on how it works. So this is the application. It's called Photo Booth Pro. And what allows you to do is to allow you to select some effects and then apply effect in real time to the camera. So for example, you can see my edge, or have you ever thought about what it looks like to have two Georgios? How about four? Yes. That's scary to my team. I love it. And you can keep playing with this. Now, the application is responsive, and it's a universal Windows platform app. So you can play this app on any device, and that's what we're going to do right now. Let me show you the project. So if we look here in the solution, I have two projects, and they're both universal Windows platform projects. The second one is basically where I have my shaders. You know, we're doing this at the GPU level. And so I have a bunch of shaders. For example, let me show you the fisheye. And I'm sure you're familiar with HSLL, but you can just look at the shaders here, think about it. And we are using the new APIs in Win2D to compile the shaders and then use the shaders at runtime from C#. So I didn't need to write any C++ code for this application. And then we're using this from my main application, where I have all of the UI. In fact, here we are in the rootpage.xaml. This is where I keep my UI. The UI, as you remember, is fairly simple. I have a grid with a split view, right, which allows me to have this view on the content on the left and a bit of content on the right. The content on the right is organized inside this grid. And so depending on the number of properties, I'm going to relay out it easily. And I do this using the Visual State Manager. Let me show you what I have a few rules inside the Visual State Manager. One is for size. And so I have a number of triggers. And depending on the width of the window, I'm going to set different properties. And it's that easy. From XAML, I can control basically the user experience across different devices. And the other one is even like a trigger on different devices. So if I'm running inside an IoT device or inside an Xbox, I might want to light up different features and different capabilities. And so how do I run this inside an Xbox? Well, let's give this a try. I'm going to just choose remote machine. I have an Xbox console here. I'm also going to use a little tool. I have a box here on the table that basically is taking the video output from the Xbox and is sending me that video output inside my PC using this third-party tool. That way you can see what's going on the Xbox from my PC. All right, so what you see inside there is actually coming from my Xbox. And now, ladies and gentlemen, if I press hit remote machine, there you go. The application launched on the Xbox. The same application. I didn't have to change any code. Is that cool? And I have a controller here plugged to the Xbox, and I can go and play with the same effects inside my Xbox console. Really cool. In fact, I can even take a picture of myself or a picture of you. Let's try this. You guys smile. Okay, be more happy, come on. Yeah, great. Ooh, something changed. And Visual Studio also gives you full debug capabilities. In fact, I can go and set breakpoint, and I can inspect, you know, my Xbox console from Visual Studio as you will do on any other PC. Not only that, we also provide a number of tools. We release what we call Device Portal, which is a web tool. It runs in the browser where you can connect in real time to any Windows 10 device. For example, right now I'm showing you what's going on inside my Xbox, and you can see the different CPU and GPU utilization. Let me close this now. All right, so we saw the Xbox. What about Windows Phone? And so I have here a 950 XL. I also connected from my device manager into my phone. And I'm going to use another application this time to project that. So I'm going to say yes. All right. And now from the device manager, if I click start, let me snap this. You should see the application launching on the device. There you go. Again, same code. The Visual State Manager is kicking in, and I can apply the same effects running in the GPU right there from my phone. So super cool. What's next? IoT. Let's take the same application now and running on an IoT, on a Raspberry Pi device. And to do this, again, I have a developer portal connected into my IoT device that is sitting here on the table. And I'm going to use another tool this time. It's called Windows IoT Remote Client. This is available in the store. And we built this application to allow you to basically see what's happening inside an IoT board, because it doesn't have a monitor. And so you can almost connect into the IoT board and project what's going on there. So let's click Connect. And this is what, you know, IoT, when you run a Windows for IoT core, what it looks like. So again, I'm going to snap this on the right. And then if I launch my application from the portal, there you go. Now I have the same application. You see the UI is different. You can imagine having a physical button, but now running from that camera, hey, ma'am, from my IoT device. So isn't this cool? In fact, just for fun, let me play all of the apps side by side here. So we have desktop, we have IoT on this corner, we have phone there, and then the Xbox here. Super powerful. All right. Thank you. It's not just about hardware. It's also about allowing you to connect into these devices. And that's why we've been investing on many APIs to help you be more productive. With Windows 10 at Build, we introduced over 2,700 new APIs. They range from new store APIs, new capabilities on the clients. What's going on?
Morning.
Hello.
Well, I thought it'd be great, since you're talking to the audience here about some of these new APIs, I'd come up here dressed in my most favorite suit ever and talk to you about some of our partners. So actually, the one partner I want to talk to you about is about Bridgestone. So I'm sure you're all aware of Bridgestone, the tire company. Well, one of the things that they're doing now across the whole fleet, actually, is actually servicing 1 million tires every year. So that's from trucks, from whether you're on talking about the couriers actually going to deliver all your parcels, to maybe the trucks that are going to deliver the groceries to the store. Actually, they all need servicing to make sure that the tires are always in a great state. So Bridgestone have 35,000 stations all across the globe that go and actually measure the tire pressures and make sure that those tires are safe for use. So one of the great things that they're doing is they moved across their good old VB or Excel spreadsheets that monitored all this to a Windows 8 application. The great thing here was it provided a great experience for those people that are at those stations. But furthermore, now, thanks to these new APIs, they want to build a Windows 10 UWP application. So I thought, what better way than to actually show you an actual real app that's utilizing some of these things? So Georgia, why don't we just show them a quick demo with this?
Sure. And again, this is the real app. It's a prototype, but it's something that Bridgestone will ship at the end of the year. So the app is called Toolbox. And allows the Bridgestone crew, like basically inspect tires and share data. You can see that as soon as I launch my app, it's using Windows Hello to welcome me in. So I might have my hands dirty, and so it's using the camera to log me into the application. And this also makes your experience more secure with your users. Once I get into the application, it's fully responsive again, so it will run on multiple devices, and I can start navigating. So let's select a fleet, then I go into my in-service tire, select this region from yesterday. It's a new inspection, and let's go to tire inspection. There are actually a lot of steps here, and that's because, you know, real apps are complex. It's not just like one screen. But how can you make that experience better for your users? And so here's what Bridgestone has done. Let me close the application, and they really leverage Cortana to jump right there. Let's give this a try. Show me my next Bridgestone inspection.
All right, looking for your next inspection.
And now Cortana knows that I have, you know, an inspection coming, and it triggered my application. It's still using Windows Hello for security reasons, and boom, it jumps right there at the last screen. So this is one way where you can improve your user experience. Let me show you another one. I'm running right now on a Surface Book, so you can imagine I can detach the book and just use the tablet, or run the same application on any other tablets with Windows 10. And so very likely I'm going to have also a pen that I can use to write. Of course, I could use the keyboard into the text box, but wouldn't it be nice if I could just type with my pen? And so, hey, what's the pressure, Shen?
I would say about 110 PSI.
Yes, no idea what he's talking about.
I have every idea of what I'm talking about.
All right. And I will say the thread depth, although I'm not sure what it is, it's low. And so I can use the pen to actually write into my textbooks, into the application. And Universal Windows Platform will translate that ink into actual text in my application. The other thing that I want to show you is actually, I think we should take a photo here and look if there is anything wrong. Do you see any nail over
no,
there?
No, this is a new tire I got this morning, so it's perfectly usable.
Are you sure?
Straight from the Bridgestone factory.
How about now?
You nailed it, eh? Come on, was that all the laugh
wow.
I got for that?
We have to take a photo of this and send it to the Bridgestone corporate team. So let's take a picture here. Thank you, Shen. Now, we need to take the important part of the picture. There you go. And now that I have a picture, I can actually annotate, and I can write additional notes and comments before I send it out. And so, of course, I can say, hey, this is a nail. Let me pick a different color here. And then the other thing I can do, for example, is I can measure, I can point using the fingers. And one thing that we introduced with Windows 10 is the ability to use both fingers and pen at the same time. So notice what I will do. I will use my two fingers here to put them on the ruler. And this allows me to move the ruler. And at the same time, I'm going to write with my pen. And you can see the ink is right there, stay aligned. So here is the nail, in case you didn't see it, guys. There it is. And that's how powerful we make that experience for UWP developers. And later we'll see how you can do this with Freya Code. Thank you, Shen.
All right, thank you very much.
So we talk about the platform, and we talk about the investment we're making in our platform. It's not just about us. It's also about the ecosystem. It's also about developers building SDKs and more on top of our platform. And at Build, we announced even more SDKs coming to the Universal Windows Platform, so supporting all of these devices. For example, Facebook announced that they're bringing their Facebook advertising network right into the UWP platform, so you can connect your applications to the Facebook SDK. This is just one example. There are others. The one that I want to show you today is something that I'm very passionate about, and it's called Vuforia. So let's roll into a different PC now. And so Vuforia, for those of you that are not familiar with it, it's the most popular augmented reality framework out there. There are over 200,000 developers already using it. And it comes as a plugin, as an extension for Unity. Unity is the tool that you're seeing right now. It's, again, a popular tool for 3D development. And so if you're not familiar with augmented reality, let me just show you a quick demo of basically how it works. I have, again, you're going to see myself a lot in the webcams today. But I'm running here inside the Unity environment. And I have here like a physical of a spaceship. And look what happened when I overlay this in front of my camera. There you go. There is my spaceship that is coming up as an augmented reality object right there in front of this physical piece of paper. Right? So this is called augmented reality. You might wonder, how can we do this inside the Universal Windows Platform app? So let me show you how you can do that. So inside Unity, I have two objects here. And you notice that they actually are the same card. This is where we are mapping a physical object to a virtual object. And so if I go here on the right, let me zoom in a bit, I can change the card, the second card, to show another battleship, Battleship 1. And you notice now that the image there changed. And I also want to associate a different 3D object to my card. And so I'm going to take a prefab, and I'm just going to drag and drop it on top of Battleship 1. And then inside my Unity project, I already have an AR camera, which is smart enough and takes care of everything else. And so now, if I'm playing this again, let's see, the first card and the second card. And they're fighting. Who's going to win? Pew, pew. This one wins. So this is augmented reality. Now, this is a game. But you can think about this also used in business context. In fact, I have another application. We took the project with Unity. We exported it into a Universal Windows Platform app. And then we can start playing with even more features. We can overlay XAML on top. We can use inking APIs and Cortana. And in this case, I have probably the most popular magazine for developers out there. I'm sure that you subscribe to this. is Yotch, Super Yotch for developers. This is the latest episode. And so I'll put it here. And notice what happened when I overlay with my Universal Windows Platform app. Whoa. It almost looks like I have a boat swimming in between all of this hardware on this table. Look at the reflection of the light and the water. So that is augmented reality inside Universal Platform app. You can clap if you'd like. I know you're speechless, probably. This is just one example. We announced at Build that Vuforia is coming to the Windows 10 platform, meaning we support devices. In this case, I'm using a Surface Pro 4, but it will support any Windows 10 device. It's also coming to HoloLens. And let me talk about HoloLens, because HoloLens is just another device that is part of our holographic platform. And so it's powered by all the Universal Platform APIs and also specific capabilities that comes with Windows Holographic that we are going to make available to any device, AR and VR, as we announced a couple of weeks ago. I want to show you, actually, how you can get started building holographic applications today. We made the tools available at Build, and so you can get started on this immediately. And so let me go back here. And this time, let me start actually by introducing the emulator. Similar to how you have emulators for phones or for other devices, we built into Visual Studio an emulator for Windows HoloLens. And you can download it today as part of the SDK. Now, because the environment is 3D, I'm actually going to use a controller. It makes it easier to navigate around. But you could also use just, you know, mouse and keyboard. And with the controller, I can move around. This is your start menu, basically, the shell where you will launch the app. And if I click around, notice what happened. It's now scanning the room. So the HoloLens is inside the room right now. Everything makes sense, right? You can see the couch, the sofa, the TV out there. It feels like Matrix. After a while, you get used to it. That's where I live every day. And so let's see how we can build an application that runs inside that environment. If I go back to Unity again, this is the same tool that I was using earlier. Again, we want it to be as easy, make it as easy as possible for developers to get started. I have an object here, a word, and I want to put this word inside my room, and then I want to be able to interact with the word. And so I implemented three core functionalities. The first one is gaze. Gaze is basically where I'm looking at. It's this vector. And so I'm going to project a little cursor on top of exactly where my gaze is. Here's the cursor. So it's just like a 3D shape. And if I go into the code for this cursor, it's C#. So again, very familiar environment for you. And I'm getting the vector of where is my head, where is my gaze. And then I'm ray casting, basically, through, you know, the physical space here to hit an object and understand where I'm looking. And when I find that object, I'm basically changing the rotation of my cursor to snap on the surface of the virtual object. I also want to be able to, number two, interact with that virtual space. And so I want to have a gesture. And so I have a gaze gesture manager. And what allows you to do is to basically detect inputs, for example, like this. We call it finger air tap, where you can just select, you know, an object on the air. And it's as easy as, you know, you're probably familiar with another platform, like on other devices or Windows, where I have tap event, and then if I'm selecting an object, I'm just going to send a message to that object. And the last thing, which is, you know, where the magic happens, is about understanding the environment around you. We call it spatial mapping. That's something that HoloLens does for you. You know, it captures the real environment and it turns it into, you know, virtual coordinates so you can apply your virtual objects on top of it. And to do that, sorry, it was that simple, to as simple as just adding a spatial mapping object into my Unity project. That's it. A lot of complex things happening right by doing that. And by the way, we open source this toolkit, so it's very easy to get started. So now if we go back to the HoloLens device, this time I'm going to put the gaze, you can see the gaze is this cursor, into my app. I'm going to select the app. I'm going to snap it just in any part of the space. You will see a short animation for Unity loading. So this is the app launching inside my virtual environment. And there we are. Now we have the world. And you can see my white cursor is snapping to the world or snapping to the surface of the room. And if I air tap, I'm just simulating it with IA, the world is going to fall and we're adding some gravity. And then I can kick the world around the room if I want. I feel very powerful right now. There you go. So that's how easy it is to get started today building universal Windows platform app for the whole graphic platform. Thank you. So far we talk about, you know, helping developers be more productive. We talk about devices, Windows devices, and the universal Windows platform that powers the devices. We also want to talk about how you can build applications that run across multiple platforms, not just Windows. And so at Build, we announced, before Build, the Xamarin is now part of the Microsoft family. I see people clapping here. I'm also excited to welcome the Xamarin team inside Microsoft. That means that, and actually some of the announcement we made, is that Xamarin is now available at no extra cost if you're using Visual Studio Enterprise, Visual Studio Professional, or the already free Visual Studio Community Edition. So basically, you can use Xamarin for free using any of this queue of Windows. This is very exciting. It's not just about the cost, but it's also about the fact that we are going to open source the runtime and the SDK of Xamarin. And we're going to add it to the .NET Foundation. So it's joining other projects like Rosalie, C Sharp, and Entity Frameworks, and SP.NET. So we're expanding that our open source investment with Xamarin and also changing the license for Mono. So we're very excited about this. The feedback we got from developers on Xamarin has been great since Build. It's also great when it comes to the Xamarin Test Cloud, which allows you to test your applications in the cloud on thousands of physical devices. So you don't need to buy thousands of different fragmented platform devices. You can just use the cloud, run the test, and let it done it for you. And again, we love it so much that we couldn't not have a demo on stage today. So let me invite Shane back to show you this. Hey, don't be scared. I'm not going to name
shy. You. Don't
be shy. I promise.
Look, if you don't put your hand up, we're going to just choose someone at random.
Be shy. Yes, yes, come on.
Oh, great. We have one. So,
they were trying to force one person, but I wanted to go for a volunteer.
If we have to have three people, it's okay. So I want to actually just going to briefly explain what I'm going to demo now. So what you see here up on the screen is a demo of an application called My Driving. So does anyone know what one of these is? It's actually called an OBD device. So what this does is it plugs into your car and brings back all the diagnostic information about it, how fast you're driving, how aggressively you're turning. Hi. I'm Shen.
Fernando,
pleasure to meet you. Fernando, I'm glad you're here because you're going to help me with this OBD device and my demo. So I wasn't the only one that wanted to dress up today, so I thought it'd be great if you get your driving outfit on, please. You look very good in this outfit. There you go, and if you grab that as well. And what I want you to do, Fernando, is can you please plug this OBD device into your car?
Sure.
This would be interesting to see where you put it. Oh, he's a professional. He knows. Okay, so the main thing about this, Fernando, I need to make sure that you're ready for the part. So I'm sure you've seen one of these. This is the sports model. It's got the wings. Please feel free to start driving. So what you can see here is I have my application, and you can see it's running at the moment, and you can see Fernando driving. Now, what I want to do is I actually want to start recording some information about Fernando's drive. Now, as you can tell, obviously, we're not in the real world, so I'm going to say user simulator. And what this is going to start doing is, as you can see at the top here, it's going to actually start recording some of this information, and it's going to be sent to Azure in the cloud to do some number crunching in Azure ML to actually understand how Fernando's driving in comparison to his peers and people around him. So I'm going to quickly stop there, because Fernando, you're a bit of a speed demon by the looks of things, before you break the law and get pulled over. So I'm just going to record this session. Now, Fernando, I think that was great. That's all I needed you for, so thank you very much. Round of applause for Fernando. He did a great job. So now I've recorded this. I just want to show you quickly what this really looks like, because this application, although here I showed it on a Windows Phone emulator, actually the great thing is it's also available on iOS and also Android. So let me show you what this looks like. So if I go here, you'll see that I have my Visual Studio application. And the main thing is, you can see that I have a few things here. I've got my shared libraries, which shows all the things that my application's using across all the various different platforms, whether you're Windows, Android, or iOS. The great thing here is, at that point then, I just have three separate different applications that monitor just the particular heads of that application. So you can see here I have my Android application, and those that are familiar with Android development will find this very familiar. I also have my iOS head, which has my main storyboards that I can develop for. And of course, for most of us, the most familiar thing here is the UWP application, which will then spread across the mobile and desktop applications. So this is the great thing about this application, that we can actually use it across all these devices. Now, there are a few great features that Xamarin's now offering. So who here writes unit tests? That's an impressive two people in this audience of developers. Who here writes tests, but only in production? So you don't test at all. Who here releases a product? So one of the things I want to show you here is something really cool. And hopefully, we can now make sure that we get more people writing unit tests. So I've got my little unit test set up here. And the one thing you'll probably notice is if I just scroll up to the top of my class, there's this little icon here. What this little icon allows me to do is to perform and write a unit test without writing any code. I literally do all the clicking and navigating on my application. So in this case, I'm going to record a new test. Let's choose an Android application. So I've already compiled my APK. I'm going to say, OK, deploy that. What we should now see on the Android emulator, hopefully, is that being deployed. Oh. There we go. See if we give it a second, it will launch. And you can see it removed it, and now it's going to add it back. So this is the experience that the user's going to get. And what I want to show you is, as I'm clicking through, let's scroll down, notice what's going to happen in this test. So I'm swiping, let's go. Let's skip authentication. And notice what's happening. Have you noticed all the code is just appearing? And I'm going to say, no, I don't want to get the latest version, because it is a live app, don't forget. And I'm just going to say, OK, well, why don't we just look at something like maybe the profile or something. And you can see right here, this is Scott Guthrie's profile in this case. He's got a great driving skill. Fernando, he's beating you. So as you can see, it records all this. Now, the great thing here is I've now recorded my test. But I need to execute on this. And we all know, as Georgia showed, that you know, the universal Windows platform has loads of devices. And so does Android, and so does iOS. So the one thing we're introducing is the Xamarin Test Cloud. So the great thing here is, I've already done some testing on my application before. And the idea is, you can upload your different packages up to the Xamarin Test Cloud, and it'll execute them against the various devices available. So I want to show you, in particular, this May 10th one, which has a failed test. I think it's kind of important. So let's just see what's going on there. Now, you see I've got one test failing. And what's important here is I've tested against 22 different devices. And the great thing here is you can have a test against a lot of devices, or maybe just the top 20 or so. So I'm going to look down the left here, and let's see what's gone wrong. So I can see I've got a red thunderbolt there. There's a bit of a problem. So these are the devices that I tested on, and they all seem to pass on the login page. But on the pass trips page, something went wrong. So I'm going to go and select that and see which device was the problematic one. As it just so happens, it's a HTC One M9. And I think the rest were OK, yeah? So I'm now going to select this. This is going to give me great level of information. The key thing to remember is I don't have to own this device. This has all been run in the cloud. So I want to know what went wrong. So the first thing I could do is I could watch a video and see what the user clicked. So I actually get visual feedback, and I get a better understanding. So you can see that the app just crashed. But sometimes as a developer, when a user tells you, yeah, it just stopped working, it's really not very useful. So you probably want to get things like stack trace, which is always really handy. So those are just a few of the things that I were touching on Xamarin. But I'll talk about more in the session later on. So I'll probably just hand back to Giorgio, and if you carry on. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, Shane.
We're going to go in much more depth on Xamarin later. There is actually not a better time also for .NET. You know, if you look, think about .NET now is available as part of the .NET framework on .NET Core and also with Xamarin. If you want to build using .NET across all the devices, we also make available PCL, portable, which basically share code across all of these devices. We're also investing in the future of .NET. And in that future, our vision is to get to a standard .NET library that powers all of them. And that's not just a minimum set of APIs, it's actually the full thing. And by doing this, allows us to innovate more quickly on .NET, as well as continue to innovate on the app model of each device and each experience. Now, this is about .NET and C#. What if you are a web developer? What if you want to leverage your investments on the web to build applications that are web applications that are cross-platform? And so we've been working for many years now on something that we call hosted web application. And the idea is simple. You can take a website, a web application, you can run it inside a native environment, and we make that very easy. And by doing that, you get exposed to all of the native APIs of the platform as well as publish it to the store. So let me show you this in action. This is something I absolutely love. So I'm going to go to this machine. And let's start with the website. The website I'm going to play is a DJ-ish application. And I'm going to select a few instruments here. Now let's play the music. And I'm going to scratch using my finger. And I can play with the volumes. I can play with individual tracks. I can change instruments and play different instruments. So this is the website, right? It feels like great also as an application. So how can we turn this into an application? Let me show you step by step. First, I'm going to open Visual Studio. We'll see later how you actually don't even need Visual Studio. You can just do it from command line. Create a new project. You have a new template in Visual Studio called Hosted Web Application. All the template needs is the URL of the website. So I'm going to take the URL of the website and say copy. And then I go back to Visual Studio. And I paste it as the start page for my application, right there in the manifest. I also need to add the content URI so that I give access to all of the APIs. And if I press debug to local machine, in a few seconds, what you will see is that website just is becoming a great Windows app. It's that easy. But let me tell you something. If all you do is this, you're doing it wrong. We don't want you to do that. We don't want you to just take a website, wrap it, ship it, boom, done. Because likely, like you want, now that you are an app, you want to leverage the native APIs. You want to, you can, and you want to do more for your users. And so let me show you what you could do. In fact, let's start from the from the code of the website. And I'm going to show the code of the website this time in Visual Studio Code. This is just a plain HTML and JavaScript website. What I have here inside my JavaScript folder, I have a bunch of JavaScript files, and one of them is smtc.js. And if you look at the code here, I'm basically checking, am I running inside Windows? And if I am, is this Windows API available? And this is the System Media Transport Control is one of the universal APIs that is available as part of the native platform. And look what's interesting here. I have JavaScript code running in the server that can call into my native APIs on my client. And in fact, if I go back to my application and I play music, that's basically what controls the hardware button on the device when you change the volume. So I can now, when I change the volume, you can see that we can, for example, switch track from here. I can pause and play right there from my application. That's how simple it is to leverage a native API. Now, that's one example of native API. There is actually, because this is a universal app, I can run it on other Windows 10 devices. And so I'm going to show you now the app running on my phone. And since it's a phone, you can imagine how you can leverage other sensors, for example, the accelerometer, to play the instrument. And so if now I'm shaking the device, and you can see how natural it feels to play these instruments right there from my web application. Thank you. I also want to play the dong instruments. I think we need the more cowbell here. And so it's a web application. So later I will show you how, but you could run it on other devices. I have here, for example, an Android device. I didn't want to play this on my phone, Windows phone, because we're going to use a proper instrument to play this. And so you can smash as hard as you want, and we're going to have the cowbell. And so let's jam a bit. All right, all of this just happening inside your web code as a web app. All right, so we talk about building applications for multiple platforms. We also, as I said at the beginning, want to cover how to build applications across other endpoints, whether those are bots or IoT. And to do this, please welcome on stage Larry Lieberman.
Great. I am so excited to see about what's going on in Windows and with the new technologies and the cross-platform development. They're all testament to how we are committed more than ever before to going to where developers are and providing you the tools you need to do the things that you want to do. That's what it's all about for us. We're going to talk about that a little bit more now. One of the things we're hearing so much about, everybody wants to build a chatbot. And it's kind of amazing. I don't know if you remember like I do. Chatbots have been around for a long time. I think one of the first things I ever saw on a computer was this thing, Eliza, which would respond to questions and pretend as though it was a person. Why have they become so big now? A lot of it has to do with all of the developments in the last few years around machine learning and artificial intelligence. So you've got on the back end the ability to intelligently interpret very complex strings and turn them into basic terms and parameters that computer applications can operate on. And this has made it much easier for people to create these types of interactive experiences. And so now you have the situation where everybody wants to build a chatbot. And it's not always appropriate. I think the first thing you need to, it's kind of like apps were, if you think about mobile apps back in 2009, everybody was thinking, I need an app, I need an app. Well, the very first question, of course, you have to ask is, what problem am I trying to solve? And that's always pertinent when you're building any type of application experience. With regard to chatbots, the question that's important is, does this conversational approach improve the experience? Does it really make it better? And you know, we've been talking, like I said, we've been talking to a lot of different developers about what they want to do. A couple different ideas, you know, I've heard of a few that are really good, actually. We have our own cloud computing platform, Azure, and Azure is extremely large and offers a million different types of things. The interactive experience of going through the Azure portal can be overwhelming. And sometimes, as a developer, you just want to accomplish one small task, like I need a connection string for a storage object. Just imagine a chatbot, and you could say, give me the connection string for my storage object. Instead of launching the portal, drilling into the correct resource group, finding the correct storage object, going in. So that type of chatbot experience can radically accelerate someone's interaction with Azure. And we're actually building that chatbot. We're going to have something, we'll probably have a demonstration of it in the next month or so. Another one that I've heard of, really compelling, I'm driving in my car. There's actually talk of having a Skype chatbot that would call you and say, hey, you just got a meeting request from Giorgio, but I see that you have a conflict at that time. Do you want me to reschedule? And you could just say yes. And so that type of interactive conversation makes something possible that's not even really possible when you're driving a car, at least you're not supposed to, look at your phone and see if you have a conflict. But because Skype knows who your contacts are, it could contact Giorgio or look at his calendar if you're on the same calendar system and actually propose that, all without you doing anything. So there are legitimate reasons why this is extremely exciting technology. But it's not for everything. And it's also not just about having a dialogue, because if you don't have the intelligence, you can have an extremely long, complex dialogue required just to order a pizza. Like, you could have like 57 steps of a dialogue to order a pizza if you don't have context and intelligence. And so that's where chatbots get more interesting. At Build this year, we announced what we at Microsoft are doing to support chatbot development. There's really three main things we're doing in this space that are around the chatbot offering. The bot framework is the centerpiece. It's a set of APIs and SDK offering that allows you to very easily put together the framework of that request-response pattern. And that's essentially how a chatbot works. You make a request, and then you get some kind of response. Request, response, request, response. Obviously, that's like very, very basic and simple. Where does the complexity come from? Well, we have a set of APIs called the Cognitive Services APIs. And this is extremely compelling. Machine learning models, rather complicated stuff. Most of the training on this, if you're an average developer, is extremely academic. about building a model, training a model, learning how to apply a model. Well, with the cognitive services APIs, what we've done is we've made it much easier to access a lot of the most popular, interesting models. And one of the most important ones is called LUIS. And we'll talk about these a little bit in a while. But understanding, actually interpreting natural language, speech recognition, face recognition, there's a number of other types of activities like that that we've added to cognitive services, and we're adding more all the time. This is what will make building chatbot experiences much more easy. And then finally, Cortana. Obviously, Cortana provides these chatbot-like experiences in the context of your phone and your personal information. You can extend Cortana. If you have a Windows application, you can extend Cortana very easily, leveraging some of the APIs we provide in Windows. That's yet another way that you can leverage conversations as an entry point into your application experience. And if you publish an app, you want to provide your audience as many different ways to access as possible. And chatting is a really natural way to do it, if it makes sense. So how do you build these? I'm just going to talk about this a little bit here. The core of this is your functionality. What is it that you are delivering? And that's here it's listed as your business logic, but obviously it can be some sort of consumer experience as well, often published as a web service. On top of that, you need to have these skills, some sort of cognitive assessment of the conversation or interaction pattern that enables you to deliver the value you want to deliver. We'll have some examples in a second. Then you want to make your creation accessible to the world. And there's a number of different ways you can do this. In the bot framework, we have a set of connectors. And these connectors allow you to take your bot and publish it through a variety of channels, like Skype, or Facebook Messenger, or Slack, or Kick. And there's more coming. But the beauty here is you write your chatbot once, and you can publish it to any of these channels. And that's amazing because, Facebook Messenger in a browser, on iOS, on Android, in Windows, on Macintosh, this is an easy way to publish your application experience, your chatting experience, on any of these platforms. If you're on Windows, you can also create these experiences by extending Cortana, like I mentioned. And finally, our connector SDK enables you to create your own connectors. And this is very compelling for a lot of reasons. Because say you have a website experience that you've delivered where you're providing some sort of service to your customers, and you want to give them the ability to ask questions at some point. So if someone's on a page in your web application and they have a question about it, your chatbot experience that you build with your own with the connector SDK can actually be aware of where they are in the page and what they're probably having a problem with, and leverage that context in providing value. So it's very extensible, and it enables you to take as much context as is available to deliver the most intelligent set of responses. The bot framework, like I said, we've talked about cognitive services. Some of the ones here that are really interesting, LUIS, Language Understanding Intelligence Service. LUIS is very compelling because what it does is it takes the natural language question and extracts intent and some of the parameters that you can then take and perform easy operations on with your application. So for example, if I got a question along the lines of, what movies are playing in Toronto tomorrow? LUIS, you could hand that string off to LUIS, just that complex string, and it could deliver back to you the intent is a movie listing. And the parameters, the timing is tomorrow, and the location is Toronto. And then you could go very easily take those and perform an operation to deliver an appropriate response. We also have a translator service available in the cognitive APIs. This, you could extend your chatbot service to provide value in other languages. Translate it to English, at which point you could use LUIS to extract these parameters. There are a number of other patterns like that possible as well. Bing APIs like Bing Image Search, really interesting. We built our own chatbot using Bing Image Search that I'll demonstrate in a second here. But there are a lot of different applications for this. The Bot Builder SDK handles the complexity of the actual interaction patterns and enables you to create the framework of that request response activity. There are a number of other things that are very common that the Bot Builder SDK will help you with as well. There are going to be situations in which people, there's some common patterns in conversation that cause problems interactively. Like if you ask a confirmation, a simple confirmation question like yes, no, if they don't, what happens if they don't say yes or no? What happens if they say banana or what have you? You have to be able to follow up and actually get a confirmation word of some kind. So that's one pattern. Another one's disambiguation. What if you can't quite get what they're saying and you say, is it this or this? Well, the Bot Framework SDK, the Bot Builder piece here, will actually provide you patterns to handle these types of, we call that multi-turn when you're going through disambiguation like that. And then finally, the connector piece. And we talked about this a bit here. The beauty of this, like I said, the ability to publish on all these channels, as well as your own custom channel, with literally not changing your bot at all, just simply adding another connection. Now let's go over here and take a look at what this looks like. All right, so I'm in Skype here. We built a bot for build, spent literally 3 days on it. It's called Project Murphy. It was initially exposed through Skype. And here it is in Skype. And what we call Murphy is a artificial imagination is one of the ways that we describe. You give it what-if questions. And you can say something very simple. And what it will do is it will perform an image search and try to come up with a visual representation of whatever you asked for. So if I say, what if, let's see if I can type here, Obama was Beethoven. That's one we use quite a lot. It's very safe. Sometimes there's a little bit of unpredictability here. And so there we have President Obama as Beethoven. So you can imagine the realm of possibilities here. What's going on? Well, the Lewis service is digesting the phrase that I put in here. And we've defined what if very specifically in this context, so there's not too much complexity to handling that. But then it's going off to Bing image search and performing an image search on Obama and Beethoven. And then we're using one of the cognitive services. Cognitive services has a face swap API. And we're just doing a face swap. And so that's the sort of thing we're doing. I happen to be a fan that's the photo here I've just opened up. You know, we launched this at Build, and it got pretty popular on Skype. Just on Skype, we were getting, like, I think it was 500,000 messages a day or something. I mean, just really a ridiculous amount of numbers. So then we went and we used the connector to launch it on Facebook Messenger, where it became even more popular. And here you can do, I'm a fan of, like, 80s television. So kind of grew up in the 70s and 80s. You know, what if John Stamos were on Three's Company? I don't know if any of you remember that show. I like that one. And it takes a second. And you get these, like, basic responses you can do here. And here it is. So that's a little more funny. Anyway, enough with the humor. Like I said, what we're doing here with the bot framework, yes, is a trivial time waster. But what are the implications? Well, if you're some sort of a bank, you could provide a chatbot service as a customer service agent, and people could ask questions like, why is there a $500 charge on my credit card from yesterday? And then the Lewis service could very easily, it has the context of who's asking the question. It knows that the account type is a credit card. It knows that the transaction value is $500 and the time frame is yesterday. And so you could take that out of Lewis and extract information to go query and see if there's more data that can be determined around why that took place. If you're interested in more information here, the key place to go is to dev.botframework.com. There's a really great talk from Build here, and there's a short URL for it. Build 2016 bots, aka MS build 2016 bots. Building a conversational bot from 0 to 60, my colleague Mike Hall did an amazing hour-long presentation going deep in depth on how to build a bot. Let's move to the next topic, which is IoT. IoT, like chatbots, very hot area, very exciting, very compelling, interesting. What is IoT exactly? You know, we've seen Raspberry Pis, we've seen a lot of these hardware devices, we've seen maker fairs, we see people, we've heard people talk about thermostats and robots and all sorts of hardware. Well, yes, that's absolutely IoT, the Internet of Things. But there's a lot of activity in this space that's been around for a long, long time. And that has to do with, you know, you have lots and lots of machines performing some sort of activity for you. And those machines produce data that you leverage to produce and promote your business objectives. So, for example, an assembly line. You may be a manufacturing company. You have an assembly line. That assembly line needs to keep working. You need to monitor the performance of all the pieces of that assembly line. And then you may want to understand more about the patterns that emerge. And so machine learning has become a really interesting thing here, because as you monitor that data, you can create and operate on a machine learning model to determine in a predictive manner when things are going to fail. And if you know when things are going to fail, you can actually go ahead and prevent them from failing by acting beforehand. Another interesting scenario has to do with vending machines. I place vending machines, and I may be a company that places vending machines all over the world, and I stock them with candy or snacks or what have you. Well, what sells and what doesn't? And when do I need to stock those vending machines? Because I don't want to just send a truck to every single one once a month, because there may be nothing gone. So how do I know when to stock those opportunistically? Again, with the intelligent vending machine sending data, and they have these now, people do this, I can track the data around what sells, what doesn't, when it sells, when it doesn't. I can even figure out what's most popular when and where, so that I can stock opportunistically. I can stock my machines with the right candy at the right time to prepare to deal with the trends and maximize income. Last year at Build, we talked about the connected cow experience. I don't know if you folks heard that one. One of the big things that was done early in the space was actually wiring up cattle with small IoT devices in order to track their behavior and movements and figure out what was associated with increasing cattle production. Because they wanted to figure out, you know, when we feed them, when we move them to the pasture, when we put them inside, how does this impact cattle production and the habits of the cattle? And they were able to, this customer was able to massively actually increase cattle production by learning and observing these patterns, tracking them, ingesting all that data, and performing machine learning models. And like I said, machine learning is pretty complicated. And so all of these things are part of this universe of the Internet of Things. And there's an enormous amount of data processing involved here in actually extracting value. All these customers, we're working with lots and lots of customers on Azure building IoT solutions that perform these operations, that ingest all this data, that enable you to perform these complex machine learning algorithms on top of that data, and to extract value and determine how to perform going forward. As you might expect, so we have a breakout on this, half hour on this later today, and I'll talk more in depth because there's a lot of moving parts here. But one of the things developers told us pretty quickly was, this is really a lot of moving parts to set up. It's really like you have to set up, you know, an IoT hub, you have to set up stream analytics, you have to set up machine learning, you have to set up some databases usually in Azure. And so all these pieces have to be configured and you know, yes, there's a lot to it. So one of the things we talked about at Build this year was our announcement of Azure IoT Suite. And the idea here was to create a prepackaged environment to get you started with some of the most important IoT scenarios that we know people care about, that people have told us they care about. And this IoT Suite solution package, there's two available now, there may be more eventually, but what IoT Suite enables you to do is you simply click a button to create a new solution, and it will set up the IoT Hub for secure device connectivity and management. That's managing all of your endpoints, which are running software. Data ingestion, command and control, actually pushing out commands. And then these dashboards, because you'll want a dashboard and visualization, and as well as integrating with your workflow as well in other ways. Another thing we talked about were Azure Functions. Now, one of the great benefits of Azure, one of the things people love about moving to the cloud, is the ability to stop having to think about managing machines. You can just simply focus on your developing your solutions. You don't have to worry about managing a server of any kind. Azure Functions takes that even further and says, you know, don't worry about even a whole solution. What about just a tiny, tiny piece of code, like a trigger that you want to fire? And you can just say, written in C# or JavaScript, you can actually just take a single function and host that in Azure Functions. And then that can become like, and it's very useful in the IoT scenario, which is why I'm mentioning here, but it's not just about IoT. You may want to use Azure Functions in all sorts of scenarios. But in the IoT scenario, you could use Azure Functions as a trigger. Say you want something to happen once you've detected a particular condition with your sensors. Then you may want to use Azure Functions. Now, I'm going to demonstrate some of this. How am I going to demonstrate it? Well, I want to show you, first I'm going to show you what the Azure IoT Suite looks like, but then we're also going to play around a little bit with some of these Raspberry Pis that we've got here. So let me switch to Machine 5, if I can do that successfully. What you'll see on the screen here, first of all, is the camera. I've got pointing at two Raspberry Pi devices. One is a sensor, and then one has a little motor with a fan on it. And we're going to sort of simulate a situation here. Both of these are on the internet, and they're both connected to Azure IoT Hub. But before I go there, I just quickly want to show you what Azure IoT Suite looks like. And this is azureiotsuite.com. I log on here, and you'll see here, I can see there's a set of solutions that I've already created that I can launch, or I can create a new solution. If I go to create a new solution, these are the two that we have right now, predictive maintenance and remote monitoring. These are two that we've been told by many, many of our customers they're very interested in implementing. Remote monitoring is about, you know, actually providing a place for devices to send their data and ingest that data around environmental sensors, sensing the environment, tracking that data, storing that data, analyzing that data. Predictive maintenance goes even further and provides you the ability to perform some sort of anticipatory analysis on when you might need to actually maintain so that you can get ahead of the curve before things break down, for example. Let's go look at the one that I have created here. I've got a solution here. It's a remote monitoring solution. Oh. And in the remote monitoring solution, we'll speed up a little bit here. I'm going a little too slow. I'm going to connect to my sensor device. This is the dashboard that you get created. In that dashboard, it's, you know, like I said, this is the starting point. With all of the pieces put together, let me just show you really quick, though. You know, I want to just go in here really quick and show you one more thing before we get here. If I select the solution, all these things here, these are all the things that get built for me with the solution. I get an IoT hub, I get stream analytics, I get DocDB, storage, app services, event hub, et cetera. Once I've done that, the initial dashboard that gets created is right here. It's hosted here. You'll see this is the data coming from the sensor device right here. And this is some of the other information coming in. I also have an Azure function set up. The Azure function, again, just this tiny piece of code hosted directly in Azure. And what this is doing is once I trigger a temperature alarm, I'm going to turn on the fan on the other device. Now, you could imagine that this is a scenario where you've got, for example, say I want to actually detect when machinery on my assembly line is overheating, and I want to cool that off. Now, we thought about using a lighter to simulate heating something up, but it didn't feel like a good idea to use a lighter on stage. So we changed it so that we're cooling it off. And when we cool it off, we're going to actually activate the fan. So I have this all running in IoT Suite. I'm going to use this compressed air to try to cool off the sensor. And we'll see here. I'm cooling off the sensor. Let's do it for a couple seconds here. And there goes the fan. And that's all going through the internet. So through IoT Hub. IoT Hub is taking care of, and I'm just amazed at that demo, actually. I know it's just turning on a fan, but the fact of the matter is that could represent fans across the entire globe that you've got on assembly lines across the globe. And if something overheats, you can turn on the fan and cool it off. And it's just an amazing functionality. This is actually the power of IoT. Think of it. All of the devices out there have computers these days. And so all of them are going to be participating in this web. And we'll talk about that more at the IoT session later on. Yes. All right, so we've got the starter kits available. We'll talk about these again in the session later. Hub device management preview, very important. Device management. You got thousands of devices out there. They're all running software. You might need to update it at some point. You don't want to go around with an SD card to all your cows in the field. Gateway SDK, not all devices can talk TCP/IP. You may need to huddle all the communication through a gateway. Let's move on to microservices. Now, this is very interesting. A lot of people think when they move to the cloud, oh, I'll just take my VMs from my data center and I'll put them in the cloud. And then I'll get fault tolerance and scalability and the ability to roll back failed deployments. And no, you don't get, you have the same problems when you put a VM in the cloud that you have when it's in your data center. You have to design your solution to actually handle problems and to be scalable. And microservices is all about rethinking how you design solutions so that you can take advantage of these things much more easily than you could otherwise. There's a couple of different layers here we talk about. Scale sets, containers, service fabric. Containers, this is sort of the first stage. A lot of people are using containers these days. One way to think of them as sort of a VM inside of a VM, abstracts out the isolation, and it abstracts out the server layer in some respects, so that your solution can be deployed to multiple different locations, on-prem, off-prem, one data center here, one data center there, and then you can actually get a standard set of APIs. The Docker and Mesos APIs are very, very popular to actually manipulate those containers so that you can scale them appropriately, you can roll back changes, you can replicate, and so forth, and get some of these benefits. But one of the areas that's becoming even more compelling right now is service fabric. And so this just released, we went general availability with it at Build this year. Service fabric is all about creating what we call the microservices. And you can think about taking a very small unit of functionality, a single component, and making that essentially its own application that can replicate, scale, roll back as needed. And it's isolated. So this enables you to actually look at the objects of your solution individually and scale them as needed, roll them back as needed, detect failure, and so forth. To demonstrate this, one of the areas that this became extremely obvious was a good way to go was in the area of real-time multiplayer games. Because you want to be able to, say you're working on a game service, you want to update that game service, but you don't want to take it down, you want to update it in real time. So we have a game at Microsoft called Age of Ascent. This was demonstrated at Build. And I like Pete, so I'm going to be Pete because I don't like to expose myself to these games. So this is the game. I've noticed with our connection, it takes a minute here. Oh, there's the, can we get the sound on 5? There we go. I'm playing my game, and I gotta be careful because I just am gonna wanna play this game. This is all Service Fabric, running this game service. Real-time, multiplayer game. This is actually a publicly released game that we've got. Every object, every ship, is a separate object. And every ship has its own state, and its own behavior, and its own failure monitoring. And this enables it. If you look at, this is Service Fabric Explorer here. I can actually go look at how my solution, my game service, is deployed across multiple nodes. These are all the components of my solution. I can actually look at the corresponding project in Visual Studio here. You'll see there's a solution here for every single object. Government, social, training drones, avatar, spaceship. All these things are components of the service, and they're managing state, they're communicating state with each other. We've got the drones themselves here. They have a health monitor. The health monitor tells Service Fabric if the component is operating appropriately or not. So what you can do here is really compelling, because say you perform an update to the service and it fails. And it fails in one specific component. Service Fabric will know which component is failing and will be able to maintain running the entire solution even though that component's failed. And in real time, it will switch to other nodes that already have the appropriate state. That state information is critical. You want to know where all the ships are. You want to know their health. But then no one will even notice that the component failed. And it will roll back and then go back to the previous version. So this is do we care about this just in games? No. All applications care about this. Because you want to be able to update solutions, complex solutions on the internet. You want to be able to do that in real time, and you want to be able to have the fault tolerance and scalability that you need in order to provide a robust solution. So this applies across the board. Games is one place where it's easy to demonstrate, but it's something everybody wants. So let's move on from, if you're interested, look, we've got a lot of partners building on Service Fabric. Let me go back to the slides here. A lot of partners building on Service Fabric, like Fidelity, for example. So financial industry, automotive, manufacturing, elevators. A lot of these companies out here are very interested in this technology. We anticipate a very healthy future for it. But one of the most interesting things about what we're doing here is that we are making Service Fabric available, and we announced this at Build. It's in general availability on Azure as of Build, but we also have a preview of a standalone version of the runtime that can be run on any cloud, on-prem, AWS, Google Cloud Engine, any cloud, because this is cornerstone of Microsoft's philosophy. We are not about making you run everything on Azure. We're about providing great solutions to developers wherever you may be. And that's what Service Fabric is about. So we're working very hard to make this available to you, and that we would like you to host it on Azure. But it's available for you wherever you might be. Okay, data and analytics. How many of you build reports? Any of you? Reporting on data, complex data, is not historically thought of as a very exciting thing. The fact of the matter is, there's almost nothing more important to telling the story of how things are going. And building complex visualizations is almost an art form. It's become a very exciting place. And Microsoft's been playing in this role, in this area, for a while with Power BI. Power BI is this tool that we released a while ago. It sort of evolved from the Office suite. And Power BI is all about building rich data visualizations. But one thing developers told us recently was, I want to be able to access those visualizations from in my web application. I don't want people to have to go access Power BI somewhere else. And so what we've done is we've given you that. We've created extensibility in Power BI. You can now host Power BI reports directly in the context of your application. So what I have here is a custom application, Fabricam Aircraft. You may be familiar with Fabricam. I heard they're doing good things. So this is a custom application here that I can go, you know, you can imagine this in the workplace being used to track inventory, parts, work orders. And if I go into reporting, I can actually go look at some of these reports that we've got here. In fleet history, I can look at engine diagnostics. I'm a very complex company. And you'll see here it's loading my custom Power BI report here on engine diagnostics. This is actually shows you the power of extensibility, because this isn't a custom Power BI report. We've actually imported some complex three-dimensional graphics here, but we've made them interactive. So I can click on a component here, and it will show me just the bar that corresponds to that piece. Say I want to build a new report. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to launch Power BI Desktop. Power BI Desktop is the report creation tool that we've got. And I'm going to just walk you through some of the steps of building one of these. There we go. So I'm going to open up a report here that has the data connections all set up. Okay, now here are all the visualizations I can create. The first one that's very common is a stock column chart. Let's click on stock column chart, and that places it right here for me. I'm gonna make it a little bit bigger. And this is a very basic thing people do quite frequently. Say I wanna track parts cost or count. Oh, I clicked it twice. Let's go back here. Let's do cost. Count. Click there. Cost. Let's do it by month. There we go. And then let's look at it by quarter. Nope, nope. Did the wrong order. Cost. Month. Quarter. There we go. So now I'm seeing the quarters are in the right colors. And a little bit of a lag here on this today. But next I want to add a scatter chart. And so the scatter chart, got to select here. There we go. Scatter chart. Scatter chart is pretty interesting because that lets you look at several different types of values at one time, like lost revenue, cost, count. And I want to look at that over. Let's drag. We need to drag the legend. We need to drag type over to the legend here in order to be able to see the different values enumerated out. And then another interesting thing I can really do here is there's a play access that allows me to look at things over time. So if I drag play to the month to the play access, I can click here in real time and I get a dynamic reporting capability that's showing me each month in turn in an animated manner. Okay, so that's very interesting. I'm a report builder, I'm not a developer say, and I save my report out. I want to be able to make this available in the application. Well, what we've enabled developers to do is create the ability to import directly into the application that custom report simply by going browse, clicking on that report, open, and then you can actually go and import it directly here. So we'll do that. I'll upload that here. And after I do that, directly in the context of my application, I have that report. And here it is. and I've got the play button just like I did in the authoring tool. So we've made it very easy. This means that the developer will no longer, it will free up the developer from having to do these reports and hand it off to the professionals who do these types of reporting operations. And we announced the availability of Power BI Embedded with support for these visuals, custom Power BI visuals, seamless customer experiences. Preview was available at Build. So now I'm going to move into my last area for today, Microsoft Graph. Microsoft Graph is an evolution of a very long road of extensibility for our Office products. Office products have been extensible for a very long time, and when we first released Office 365, developers clamored to get access to extend it because I think Giorgio mentioned earlier, 1.2 billion users of Office 365. It just boggles my mind every time I say that number. But one of the things developers told us quite frequently was that this is very hard because all the different aspects of Office had a completely different structure to their extensibility. So if I wanted to access files in OneDrive, if I wanted to get at my email, if I wanted to get at my messages, if I wanted to, all of this data was accessible differently, and you had to authenticate and get a different token for all of it. So what we've done with Microsoft Graph is we've unified all of this into a single namespace, a single REST API, and we've correspondingly seen enormous growth, a single sign-on with one token. And the response has been amazing. What I've got here is our Graph Explorer, and anyone can go take a look at this. It's just graph.microsoft.io. This allows you to very easily play around with the API. Once you've logged in with any Microsoft ID that's got Office 365, here we are logged in as Garth. I don't know Garth, but here's the basic URL here. Graph.microsoft.com v1.0 me, and that does like an Active Directory query to get the information about me, and I'm Garth in this instance. But I could also go me/messages, and then that will go against Office 365 Exchange Online, and that's returning my messages in a JSON file. I can also just go me/events, and that gets my calendar events back in a JSON file. Or the other one is, I have trouble remembering the other one. The other one is drive root children for OneDrive. Drive root children. And that will get a directory listing of my OneDrive. And say I want to, actually, the other thing we're doing here is we're giving you access to a pre-release. So what we've done with the namespace in a RESTful manner is we've created a beta where you can go /beta/me. And one of the areas that's currently not released, it's in beta, is people. And I can go me/people, and I get back a REST file of the people that I have stored in my Office 365 account. So this is ridiculously simple for people to take this information and leverage it in the context of their enterprise. So we've seen enormous growth here. It's quite exciting. And it's really gratifying to see people be excited about this because a lot of effort went into rationalizing all this information with all this different history in Office, bringing it together in a meaningful way to respond to the real world needs of developers.